Wild Missions original podcast.
Humans may be the world's top predator, but what happens when the tables are turned and we become the hunted? For many people around the world, the feeling of being watched, stalked, or even eaten by a predator, such as a big cat, is a terrifying reality. We're working to protect what wildcats we have left, and even increase their numbers. But how do we balance this against the complexities of a world where increasingly people and predators live side by side? In this episode, we'll hear from Professor Adam Hart, author of The Deadly Balance, People and Predators in a Crowded World, and explore the spine-chilling topic of human predation by big cats, and what the future holds as we continue to push into wildlife habitats. I'm Andy Barbell, and this is Cats of the Wild, episode 31, When We Become Prey. This is Professor Adam Hart.
And I'm based at the University of Gloucestershire.
Adam is a Professor of Science Communication, and his main field of study is actually entomology, the study of insects. Now, I know that's a bit odd for a podcast about wild cats, but he's always been interested in large mammals and their social interactions.
I kind of became, I suppose, an entomologist by mistake, really. I was interested in them, but I kind of got into studying them professionally. But I kept up the ecology side of it and the big mammal stuff. And I guess over the last, decade or so, really, I've been much more looking at sort of general ecology and particularly looking at African ecology and grassland ecology and stuff.
In The Deadly Balance, Adam explores an intricate issue in wildlife conservation, how humans and animals can peacefully coexist in the same environment, despite the fact that some animals may even pose a threat to humans by preying on them.
The book is basically an examination of the predators that can eat us. So that's basically the sort of central kind of cloud here, is that there are predators out there that regard us as potential food, and in some cases as food. And the predation of humans by wild animals is not as uncommon as people might think. So there's this sense that animals live somewhere else and that people live here. And so actually I sort of wanted people to start to break that down and realize that actually people and animals in many parts of the world live together in the same area. And that's good, right? If everyone's happy and safe and stuff, that's wonderful, because otherwise we end up with just wildlife behind fences in national parks. And that's not what anyone wants, or at least that's not what I want. It's not what I think a lot of people want. So yeah, I wanted people to just think about that. But you know, in terms of how useful that is, I don't know. I hope at the end of the book, at least people might have a slightly more nuanced view of how conservation works and how you need to be thinking about communities and people, so that if it comes to donations, they maybe scratch through the surface a little bit and actually see what particular NGOs or particular groups are doing in terms of real actual conservation, as opposed to here is a big fluffy charismatic animal.
Here in Australia, we're known for having plenty of animals that can kill you, such as the eastern brown snake, the box jellyfish, cone snails, and the blue-ringed octopus. Adam makes a point to distinguish that these animals aren't necessarily seeking out humans as prey, but rather act in self-defense. However, the same cannot be said for big cats, such as lions, tigers, leopards, and jaguars, which have been known to prey on humans in some cases.
I was very keen to steer towards those animals that we have good evidence for hunting and killing us. And turns out there's quite a few of those. And then, yes, within those, of course, you know, any tiger, for example, could quite easily make a meal out of pretty much any mobile human. But where human beings were in their zone. But will they all attack us? No, not necessarily. A lot depends on their ecology. There's the injury hypothesis, I suppose you could call it, where only sort of old and infirm animals turn into man-eaters. That may be true in some cases, and it may have been true, certainly in early 1900s when Jim Corbett and people were were active around this, that they were a big fan of this hypothesis, and many of the man-eaters they shot showed evidence of previous injuries, but that isn't always the case. But yeah, there definitely seems to be a pattern in some predators where some of them will turn to that behavior, and it may be because of that, but sometimes it's not. In the case of tigers, it seems to be younger, more inexperienced males seem to be particularly prone to doing it. They're roaming around, they get shoved out of their sort of natal territory, you know, where their mummy is basically, and they get kicked out, and they're nowhere near big enough or strong enough to take on any of the dominant males. So they're kind of shifting around on the edges, and because of the nature of habitat fragmentation and everything else, the edges of those habitats also tend to be the edges where we are. And so certainly one idea is that the increase that we've seen in tiger attacks in India could well be linked to that in some way. You know, leopards appear to be a growing problem in parts of India. And again, there's probably some animals that learn. I mean, these are clever animals, actually. And they'll learn techniques and tactics. And, you know, they like hanging around. They like killing feral dogs. Leopards love dogs. It seems to be a truth. I remember the first time I talked to anyone in Africa about leopards, it took about 2 minutes for them to go onto a horrendous story about how one had killed his family pet. And then proceeded to say, almost as a truism, oh, you know, leopards love eating dogs. And I thought, okay, that's just, you know, that's one of those things that people say, right? And then I heard it a few more times. And then sure enough, I spoke to people in India, and it seems that the feral dog population is actually driving this increase in leopards. And you know, some of those will then be hanging around in situations where they suddenly realize that, you know, particularly children, smaller people, infirm and elderly people, you know, easy targets basically can end up being quite vulnerable. Drunk people, a particular lesson I think to be learnt from work done in Tanzania, where apparently lions can recognize you if you're drunk, and obviously staggering around sort of back from the bar of an evening. I figure if we can spot a drunk guy, you know, 200 meters away, a lion is more than capable, and apparently they are capable of doing that and learning that, you know, certain routes and so on are easy meat, I mean, I guess is the phrase. So, you know, I'm not trying to vilify these animals, but we have to understand that these interactions exist if we want to help and try and do something useful rather than just pretend that it's all like the Lion King. And I mean, you often hear people say, oh, an animal will never attack a human being unless it's cornered and it's all blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, that's, you know, utter nonsense. It's utter twaddle. You know, that's why when people walk around in big five areas and so on, they do so with a guide with a rifle. And that's why people are amazingly careful around, don't go swimming in crocodile rivers. You know, it's nonsense to suggest that we're somehow, it's quite arrogant, actually, isn't it? It sort of suggests that we're somehow imperious and above the rest of the natural world, even though we're kind of the same size and shape as food.
Something really stood out to me reading the book is the numerous times Adam talked about predators actually eating people. In fact, I counted, it's in the book over 50 times. It's not uncommon to hear about animals attacking or killing humans, but the thought of them actually consuming people takes the gravity of the situation to a whole new level.
I want to make people realize that these are predatory attacks. They're not all, right? But the vast majority of them are predatory attacks when an animal is looking at us as food. And I think that is important because there's something very visceral about the idea of being stalked and hunted by a wild animal that wants to make you lunch. You know, that's or make lunch of you, more accurately. You know, and I think that was really something that I wanted to drill down into and bring home to people, the horror of that, really. I talk at the beginning of the tiger chapter about a photograph that was sent to me quite early in this process by a remarkable guy called Rajiv Mathew, who's tried to collate all this data in India, which is just a, as he would say, a fool's errand probably, because it's just so complicated to do and so difficult. But, you know, he's collating all this from everywhere, and he's always sending images and stuff, and it's harrowing. And I think people need to understand that. It's easy to dress up these sorts of conflicts with words that don't really convey what's actually happening.
The notion that humans can fall prey to big cats and other large predators is not meant to be sensationalist, but rather to alert those of us who live in urban or other predator-free areas to the reality that such incidents can and do occur. While we sit comfortably in our homes, thousands of kilometres away, advocating for conservation efforts to increase the number of lions and other predators, it is crucial to recognise that it is the people living in these areas who are the most affected, not us. It is a reminder that we must have empathy for those who face such risks on a daily basis, as it is often those who are the most vulnerable and marginalised who bear the brunt of such attacks.
I think we need more stories. We, as scientists, we're very bad at doing this. We assume that everyone's going to respond to facts because that's what we do. So we sit and tell people the rational facts and then sit back and go, well, our job is done here. And it's like, no, no one's taking any notice. And it's the same everywhere, really. So I think we need to be much better at getting people's stories and getting people to raise awareness. But it's more than that. It's to have an empathy and to have an understanding that actually these are people that are being affected and they're just like us. You know, people around the world, it's a remarkable thing, actually, when you're traveling around the world. The one thing you really realize is that no matter where you are, actually, people are people. and we're normally pretty similar. And fundamentally, we've all got the same kind of desires and the hopes and everything else. And I think that often gets lost as well. And partly, you know, because we do use terms. I mean, we've used them in this talk, but you know, we use terms like communities and so on, which again, is a remove away. And it can kind of sort of give that impression that it's different. And I think, yeah, we probably key to having a more nuanced conservation message is including people in it much more explicitly and upfront. And interestingly, some of the bigger conservation organizations, when you join them or you get sent their blurb, they're really good on doing that. Really good. But that's not how people get dragged in. They get dragged in by big posters. I get that from a marketing perspective. I understand why they're doing it, but it's frustrating because actually the really interesting thing is the story. But, you know, I suppose that's, yeah, it's a struggle, but it's one that we need to do far better at.
If we want to tell better stories about wildlife conservation and the threats that exist, it is crucial to put a human face on those who are most affected. It is all too easy to speak in broad terms about people living in areas with predators or local communities, but until we start identifying specific individuals and giving voice to their experiences, the issues remain abstract and difficult to fully comprehend. By sharing the stories of those who live with these risks every day, we can help bridge the gap in understanding between those living in predator-free areas and those who must coexist with them. Only then can we truly appreciate the complexities of conservation and work towards creating solutions that take into the account the needs and realities of all people involved.
Certainly, if you're not sort of deep in the kind of technical journals and so on, you're getting information predominantly from the media in whatever form that is. And so the way that these stories are depicted is important in terms of how people are going to engage with them and potentially go from awareness to action or even get to the stage of awareness, actually. And yeah, it became really clear as I was researching the book. And it was I kind of knew it before, but I hadn't really sort of thought about it and crystallized it really. Yeah, I'm taking a very Eurocentric viewpoint, but the depiction of conservation in many parts of the world is almost inherently racist in the way that it's done. I mean, I was actually talking to someone yesterday. I was at an event and it was an Australian was there and he was down near Adelaide and we were talking about saltwater crocodiles and stuff. And he was saying that even in the Australian press, actually, you know, some kind of attractive surfer gets hit by a crocodile and it's front page story. But actually up in the Northern Territories where people are collecting eggs and people are fishing and so on and they're getting attacked, well, that, you know, doesn't quite grab the headlines as much. And he was saying, you know, even within Australia, that's the case. And we see that from European side of things, you know. And very often it's a very common thing that even if stories are reported, which is rare, it's very rare that people are named. There's often a sense of victim shaming. So there were the three boys that were killed in the Ngorongoro crater in Tanzania. And it was a horrendous, horrendous situation. And I think one of them was actually watching the other three getting killed. I mean, they were killed and eaten by a lion. I mean, to watch that, you're never going to psychologically recover from that. In reality, that's always going to be with you. It's really, when you actually put yourself in that position, it's horrendous. You think about the families, you know. I've got children. The notion of one of them being eaten by a lion, you know, it's horrific. It's actually hard to even fathom. And, you know, that happened and it was reported in the press, actually, in the UK. I think because there were three of them. But immediately, you know, you read below the line, or you know, which is always an error in newspaper stories online, or you go onto social media and you see this narrative emerging of people saying, well, what were they doing there? You know, they shouldn't have been there in the first place. There's this sort of very, and it's like, well, hang on, you know, they live there. That's where they live. And it really underpins, I think, or reinforces the idea that people have this notion of us and wildlife, and they don't understand that people live in these areas and that wildlife lives in these areas, and that sometimes that goes wrong, but it's not their fault.
One of the most ambitious global conservation programs recently was TX2, a global commitment in 2010 by 13 range countries to double the world's tigers by 2022. On paper, it's largely been a success, driven by population increases in India, Nepal, Bhutan, Russia, and China. But it's also come at a cost to the people living in these areas, with India recording a record 126 tiger-related deaths in 2021.
Like with all predators, tigers' range has massively contracted, it's fragmented, the numbers are down. But by building the numbers up and building corridors, we can start to kind of improve it. So that was a sort of pledge undertaken by tiger range states. And I think Nepal was the first country to do it in around about 2020. And India is tricky because tigers and lions are political as well as ecological, and it's hard to find numbers, and these things are intrinsically quite hard to count as well. You know, it's tricky to survey, but it would appear that India has achieved this as well. But yeah, the problem is that you end up with more tigers, and that's the thing. Your solution is more tigers, but that is also the problem, because when you have more tigers, the nature of tigers particularly is that they have very large home ranges. There's not like there's infinite space for these tigers. So the first problem that you have is that, yeah, as tigers move out, they've got to go somewhere, and they will go from forest habitats, which might be ideal to them, into less ideal habitats that start to then grade into agricultural landscapes and human-dominated landscapes. And there's food there in the shape of livestock and then also people. So you're sort of inevitably kind of seeping them out at the edges. There is only a limited number. The second thing is that there's no natural predators for tigers, and they're heavily protected. Now, that wasn't the case in the past, which is why there are so few of them. But it does mean that you have tigers that have grown up now. Generationally, there is no memory of humans as being a problem. So I'm sort of taking this from people that live in India. I don't know that we've got sort of an evidentiary base for this, but for people that live with tigers and for people that have studied tiger attacks and so on, their theory here is that you've got tigers with no sense of fear of humans, because in the past humans were hunting them and actively shooting them, and tigers would, you know, I guess see that, and you know, they're not stupid, and they would avoid us. But they don't have that anymore. They have no reason to fear us. And on top of that, you've got people who probably generationally have no real memory of living in forests where tigers were a real and present danger. So you've got that sort of breakdown in some areas, not all, but in some areas, of the ability to be able to live alongside them from both sides. So that's potentially a problem too. Certainly in some areas, like the Bardia National Park had a real spate of tiger attacks, like more than a dozen people got killed and eaten. You know, they were predated. It wasn't just sort of a defensive attack gone wrong. No. They were gone, right? They were eaten. And those attacks were basically the exact result of a major conservation success, because there were so many tigers in there. And then there's a whole load of other complexities going on involving extraction from a river, which then lowered water levels, which brought animals out of forests and meant that people had to go further into the river. And then COVID actually came up here as well, because it forced people to go back into the forest and they weren't able to go. So you have this horrible mix of factors. You've got more tigers in an area, you've got different interactions of tigers and humans than they were in the past. You've got people being forced into the forest because that's where they get the resources. You've got tigers being either forced out of the forest or hunting along the now lowered river, where animals are being focused and concentrated, which is wonderful for them. And then you've got people there, and the whole thing ends up in a predictable but unfortunate mess. And it's underdriven by gravel extraction further up or something else. And in a way, that's one of the things that lures me to this topic, right? It's just this horrible complexity is fascinating, and sort of it's like a moth to the flame. You can't help yourself, but it's ultimately very, very difficult to unpick. And even when you do unpick it, something else will throw up in the mix, and you'll end up with, you know, some other thing that comes through that no one's thought of. You know, I mean, COVID threw a real banner in the works for all sorts of things. You've suddenly got people being forced to get food, which means that they may be poaching, or they may be collecting stuff from areas where they're not supposed to be, which puts them at risk. And you've got fewer people out on patrol, and that causes conservation concerns, and, you know, all kinds of little subtle things around the outside. So when we want to increase predators, we think, yay, that's a good thing, but we have to understand what the repercussions will be.
Living alongside predators is not without its risks, yet the resilience of human communities living in these areas is nothing short of remarkable. Big cats, along with other predators, play a crucial role in maintaining the balance of ecosystems, and they can even provide numerous benefits to the people who live alongside them.
There's some really interesting benefits, actually. I mean, first of all, it's not like they're constantly ravening at the door. They may be in some places, but most of the time, right? So it's not like it's that. But there is a residual fear in many people that's sort of debilitating and has sublethal effects. But yeah, there's all kinds of benefits actually to predators. From an ecological viewpoint, there are benefits. Predators structure ecology. They actually promote biodiversity and so on. But from a very human-centered perspective, you've got the opportunity to gain direct benefit from those predators, tourism being an obvious one, although there are other opportunities too, controversially hunting, but also in the case of things like crocodiles, they're raged for skins. So there are cash benefits that you can get, but there's lots of other really cool, subtle benefits. So hyenas, for example, which are predators but will also scavenge, are fantastic at scavenging carcasses of livestock, and they'll eat anything. They don't care if it's got anthrax or bovine tuberculosis or whatever. If it all gets wolfed down or hyenaed down, I suppose would be the correct verb, and then digested, and they produce a rather fetching sort of white chalky turd, and then that's the end of that. So they're an amazing way of clearing out this disease, and it's been estimated in some parts of Ethiopia you can work out the cash benefit in terms of the disposal of carcasses, but also the benefit from the saving of veterinary medicine from the diseases that would have spread from those carcasses, and human lives, which is really interesting. They also, hyenas do this thing they hunt, and they hunt dik-diks and small antelope, which are herbivores on cat, K-H-A-T, which is a drug that's grown in parts of the Horn of Africa. And even though they come with a cost, because they will occasionally attack people, the local farmers, you know, really like the hyena's presence, because they get rid of all these herbivores, and they have a benefit to their crops. And interestingly, in areas where that happens, about 85% of people, they want hyenas around. But then you've got areas where they're only basically going and eating donkeys, and they do seem to like donkeys, you know, they don't see the benefit, right? So it depends on the area. But there's a really nice one to finish on, perhaps. There's a really nice benefit from cougars, which has been looked at in some depth, which is that cougars eat deer, and deer run onto roads and cause traffic accidents. And you can work out how many traffic accidents are caused by deer, and then you can work out how many deer are reduced by cougar presence. And so you can start to work out the number of people and injuries that would be saved over a sort of time frame if cougars were in an area. And someone analyzed this for the eastern United States, and yeah, the cash savings is well over $1 billion. I can't remember the actual numbers, but the number of human lives is high, and the number of injuries even higher. We're talking, you know, tens of thousands of injuries saved. And that's a really interesting benefit of predators that we perhaps don't think of. However, a hard sell, because that is a notional future benefit to someone that may not be you, and we're not very good. In fact, the last book I wrote actually was that sort of finishes on this notion. It was about us in the modern world, and one of the things we're staggeringly bad at is sort of notional benefits to someone other than us. However, there are all sorts of advantages of predators. We want a world with predators in there, but we also need a world where people can safely live around them. And I think that's where we need to be going. And central to that is going to be understanding that interaction, but putting people in that kind of equation. And I think that's where certainly a lot of high profile conservation in terms of the media and things tends to fall down a little bit. My name is Adam Hart. I'm Professor of Science Communication at the University of Gloucestershire. If you'd like to find out more about what I'm up to, then follow me on Twitter, Adam Hart Science, or Instagram, actually, in the same handle, Adam Hart Science. And if you want to find out more about what we've been talking about today, please do go ahead and buy my book, The Deadly Balance, out now from Bloomsbury.
Big thank you to Professor Adam Hart for his time. I found his book fascinating. And whilst it covers big cats like lions, tigers, and leopards, there's also some really interesting chapters on crocodiles and other large predators. It's called The Deadly Balance, and you can find it online or at a bookstore now. Cats of the Wild is created by me, Andy Varvel. Theme music is by Score Squad. Other music and sound effects from Envato.